again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal, and very proud to alert you today to the fact that if you're listening to this, it means that our first issue of January 2016 has been released, and that means that we have officially entered our anniversary volume. This is the 50th year of medical education, and we've planned many activities and resources to try to help the journal and the field and all the people who have been involved with it celebrate reaching that milestone. Over the course of the coming months, you'll find retrospective commentaries on each paper that's been most cited in every five-year period of the journal. We'll have an in-person celebration at the ASME annual scientific meeting in Belfast in July, and a couple of other special issues and resources are coming your way. I would strongly encourage you to go to the website, www.mededuke.com. Click on Read, and first and foremost, you'll find a flippable PDF there that's a bit of an online supplementary issue that is really about tracking some of the history of the journal and seminal moments and some of the interesting things that have happened along the way. This first issue of the year, our annual State of the Science issue, was similarly dedicated to 50 years of medical education. And what we did this year was the deputy editors and I went out and tried to seek pieces that represented the continuum of health professional education and offered both some reflection on where we stand after 50 years of the journal, as well as offering some ideas as to productive lines of study and inquiry and innovation that might occur over the next 50 years. Nobody wants to get too deep into prediction making, as that's one of the best ways to be wrong. But nonetheless, there's some great works that you're going to find in the January issue, thanks to the many authors who stepped up and wrote them and the many reviewers who offered their sage advice. One of those articles I have the joy of speaking with you about today is titled "Alignment Achieved? The Learning Landscape and Curricula in Health Professions Education," and it's been authored by Jonas Nordqvist, who's Associate Director for Residency Training at the Karolinska University Hospital and Director of the Medical Case Center at the Karolinska Institutet. Thank you, Jonas, for joining me from Sweden. I know you're right in the middle of jet-setting around the globe.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Your paper takes us in a novel direction, I think, relative to just about everything else I've seen in the field. There's a bit of a literature on learning environment and a growing literature on social materiality and the way that physical things impact upon education in the health professions. But I know from having spoken with you over a few years now that your interest in part is about how the physical space impacts upon learning. Can you tell our listeners a bit about why you think that's an important topic?
I'm delighted. I think that many times we do education reforms of various kinds, but what's overlooked is the physical environments in which people actually operate a curriculum. Think about a restaurant. A restaurant or a hotel are highly dependent on the physical presence of the business. If you're not attractive enough, you won't get customers coming to your place. They will go somewhere else. Medical schools has perhaps, generally speaking, not been so much aware of the expression of the mission and the vision of a medical school as such. And sometimes they look very different. Sometimes there are some differences. But that is perhaps not the most important thing. For me, what has been most important is that teaching and learning methods going into active learning, peer-to-peer learning, etc., are not embedded into a physical environment where these things normally are enabled. So I think that the whole issue about learning environments in terms of its physical presence has been overlooked.
Well, and I've certainly heard it said that the style and position and placement of a building sends implicit, if not explicit, messages to people about how much that institute or organization is valued. What is it that gives you cause to believe that the physical space would actually impact upon learning itself, as opposed to simply whether or not people were interested in attending that school?
Well, if you look into other sectors, if you look into hospital design, for instance, that's where we have quite some good evidence. There's a study back in the 1980s where you saw clearly how a window impacts a number of variables in terms of patients were rating sleep better, less painkillers, they rated nursing care much better when they moved from one kind of environment to another kind of environment. And there are studies from primary school settings and from high schools that clearly show that environmental factors are important. If we go into the area of higher education, there is not that much evidence. But sometimes it's quite evident that many of the medical schools, when they were designed in the 1930s or in the early 1900s, they were designed in a completely different era where discipline-based teaching and learning was the way we organized curriculum. Didactic lectures was the main way to teach in a medical school. But over the last 50 or 60 years, all of this has changed, and we are moving into a much more active learning era, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. And from that perspective, we are stuck in all premises. And the evidence here is not yet there, but we certainly can see from other sectors that space does impact the number of variables. And this is one of the areas we have to look much more deeper into, I would argue.
And you've started us down that road by conducting this review, and as you already alluded to, we're forced to go out and look into places beyond health professional education to try to get a sense as to what impact these things would have. What appears to be highest priority in your mind at this point in time, given what you've seen from other literatures?
I think that the number one issue is awareness. Awareness in a sense that as soon as we start to discuss curriculum reform of any kind, I think that the aspect of the physical learning environments that needs to be connected to such a reform need to be on the agenda. That doesn't mean that we always have to change the physical learning environments, but I do argue that any reform on the, should we say, the software side, and what I mean by that is the curriculum as such, teaching and learning methods, assessment methods, etc., etc. Once we do changes here, it may or may not have impact on the hardware, that is the physical learning environments. But just the fact that this seems to have been a rather blind area, that we have not paid attention to that over the last 50 years or so, is alarming. And I think that that is one of the probably most important things now, is just to start to become aware of it. And the lack of studies in this area is certainly an indication of the lack of awareness, I would argue.
Well, and I imagine it's difficult to study, given that to, for sake of argument, design some form of intervention, you would need different types of spaces. In the literature that you found, how have people most effectively looked at the influence of these issues?
But I think that the majority of the studies we have in higher education is sort of case descriptions, mm-hmm. where they describe an intervention. And that's good enough, because that sort of shows that at least there'll be some kind of awareness. The most systematic studies you will find is not from higher ed, but they are mainly from primary schools and secondary schools. And within the frame of the OECD, there's been quite a few big studies when you look on a country scale to see how should you design kindergartens or how should you design primary schools in order to achieve certain outcome targets.
Okay. And then do those lead to any particular universality in terms of the conclusions that are drawn, or does the influence of the physical space seem to be quite different dependent on the context?
There are some set of variables that seems to be general and applicable everywhere. And that goes into, it might sound very common sense, but nevertheless, this has been shown now. And that is that the air quality, acoustic control, all those environment, heat, etc., etc., all those environmental factors do have a significant impact on learning outcomes for students. Now, this has been taken again from other sectors where perhaps pupils that in this context spend much more time in one same classroom over the period of 1 year or so. So in higher ed, where people move around within classrooms, this may not have the same impact perhaps on individual students. But nevertheless, these things do impact. But when you look into the actual design of classrooms, you look into, would there be a magic bullet for how to design a classroom? The answer is no. It really depends on what you like to achieve, and that's very content dependent. But I would argue that, as in most other cases, what we need to have is to have a very balanced approach. I think that there are lots of evidence why lectures still should be where they are, and lectures sometimes can be very good. So I'm not against all lecture theatres in any way, but what we need to have is a variety of spaces. And in particular, we need to think about the informal spaces, because technology and all new learning resources you can access on your device or your iPhone or smartphone enables you to do lots of studies outside the classroom. And the question is, what spaces do we provide students where they can actually access space within our own institutions? If they don't find spaces within a medical school attractive enough, they'll go somewhere else. They will end up by Coffee by George downtown or somewhere. And that is not a problem. But the problem is that we as a university want to be the primary choice for our students. We want students to form groups of learners, community of learners within our campus. And here, since technology enables students to do so many things outside the classroom, we need to have very attractive spaces so they stay and work on campus or in informal places within the hospital as well.
In your comment about the air quality and the lighting and all those things led me to realize I should have probably started by asking you to define physical space or spaces as you're thinking of it. It obviously encompasses any number of things. Is there some easy way to put limits around how you'd like people to think about that concept?
Yes, and you were asking earlier also about where we might want to go. And I think that the whole issue about clarifying what we mean by physical learning spaces is very important. Because if you look into the literature and you look into all those case studies that has been published, they deal with physical learning spaces on a number of levels. And we published a paper earlier this year where we are launching the idea. It's me and Andrew Lang in New York, where we are launching the idea about what we call the networked learning landscape. And a networked learning landscape is in our world operationalized on four different scales. On the low scale, you have the classroom in a building. Mm-hmm. But outside the classroom, you have lots of connecting spaces in the same building. And these are informal spaces. And then you have the building as such. But outside the building, this space in between a building and another building. And that's another level, another scale to think about learning spaces. And then, of course, you have the whole campus and how that relates to the urban fabric in general. So I think that when we think about learning spaces, many times we isolate our thinking to the classroom. But what you have seen since the end of the 1990s and early 2000 is an increased awareness and increased attention being given to informal learning spaces. And when you read those studies, they just focus on the informal learning spaces and they tend to neglect the classrooms. And if you speak about classrooms, you tend to ignore the campus. So I think that by clarifying what we mean by learning spaces and try to be very clear about what scale of learning spaces we are discussing, that is also when we can start to think about the integration of various learning spaces on various scales. Because classroom certainly is integrated to the informal spaces. Informal spaces are part of the overall campus structure. And not to see projects isolated on any point of the scale, rather to see how different scales can interconnect. That is absolutely critical in order to develop learning spaces. And without that, you can't have a coherent strategy.
In my context, one of the places where this is most apparently playing out is in libraries. Mm-hmm. The university libraries have been transitioning very deliberately away from places where there are stacks of books lined up one after another towards spaces that are more integrated and desirable for learning in the way that you're describing it. Is that where you imagine this might most likely play out immediately, or are there other things that you're seeing that you would classify as indicators of awareness or growing awareness of the issues that you're trying to draw our attention to?
I think that libraries is one part of it. And libraries are in a way out of business, because ebooks and journals, you can find them anywhere in a nanosecond through your computer without any coffee on them at all. And the idea that the university library is the collection of books is some 15 minutes ago. So what do you do with this space? They have become learning grids, learning commons, call them whatever you like, learning information resource centers, etc., etc. So I think that technology really has driven university libraries to think about how they use space. But to some degree, in many universities, that has been an isolated development from what then happens in the classrooms. And then you have another group of people working with the spaces outside the library, but not in the classrooms. And then you have another group of people working with the master plan of a university. So I think that you can see in one same institution that there might be many different groups working with learning spaces, perhaps not always in the same direction, perhaps always not with the same thinking. And I think that to some degree, if we start to think about learning spaces from an overall perspective as a networked learning landscape and become aware of that, we could create much more coherent strategies where, let's say, library spaces better and in a more optimal way could support what we do in a classroom and also how other spaces are being developed. I just came back from an institution in the beginning of this week, and this institution, should we say, have a rather high level of awareness about learning spaces. But what you tend to find is, again, that there are so many different projects within the same institution, and there's so many different groups. They're all interested in learning spaces, and that's great, but there's no coherent thinking of learning spaces and no overall strategy, and for sure, there is no connection to the curriculum.
And that notion of coherence and, you know, trying to think carefully about this is obviously a fundamental message for you in your paper that would actually be a really good note to end on. But I want to end instead by playing devil's advocate for a minute and saying that...
Oh, please do. I'm delighted.
Purely to give you a chance to respond to individuals who undoubtedly you will encounter who... First of all, we'll argue that there are a lot of trends in education, and people will say that in a derogatory way, as though your ideas, your innovations, they're just the next thing, and it doesn't really matter. Sorry, I should also say I'm on record as saying I actually think trends and fads are a good thing that we should encourage more than that they need to be avoided. But when we think about physical space, to make a change is quite expensive, and to do so without greater certainty about the impact that it would have obviously is taking a bit of a risk, certainly to the administrators who are worried about the budget breaking even. What do you say to those people who would argue that better space might be nice, but it's incredibly expensive, and so we just have to make do with what we have?
Well, I think that there are a few things I would like to say to them. Let's start with the fad. I completely agree. I mean, you and I would know that there's always something new on the educational catwalk. You go to what I sometimes call the international educational fashion shows, the big conferences. And there's always something new coming up on the catwalk. At least every 5 years, there's something new. And if you design something, and if you now isolate the conversation to the classroom scale and try to accommodate new learning spaces that would fit nicely with the new educational method, I think that people raising concerns about that might have a valid point. I think capital investment in infrastructure in buildings is super, super expensive. And you can't rebuild every 5 years or sometimes not even every 10 years. You have to build for longer periods of time. I'm personally very much against what I would like to call for methodological fetishism. And that means that when you're designing, if you're a methodological fetishist, then you will design specifically for individual methods like team-based learning or problem-based learning or case-based learning, whatever. I think that what we need to do is to revisit the underlying principles and the underlying theory of contemporary medical and higher education. And a way to do that would be to look into what are all those methods trying to achieve. And I would say dialogue is one thing that is very important that underlines quite a lot of what we see today. Visualization of your previous knowledge and learning is another principle that comes back in many of the methods you see today on the catwalk. Peer-to-peer learning and collaborative learning are things that are also recurring in the conversation. So I think that when you do design spaces in the classroom on the informal space, do not design them for specific methods. Rather, to see the performance of the space must enable dialogue, must enable visualization of previous knowledge and learning, etc., etc. And if we can design based on those principles, then we get a theory-driven design approach rather than a specific method-driven approach, which I think is much more important.
And actually, your answer makes me even happier to have not stopped where I was tempted to, because I think that is a wonderful note in terms of thinking about how do we move forward in the future, how do we prepare for it, how do we keep our eyes on the foundational principles that we want to follow as opposed to what we might have done in the past. And that's a perfect note representative of what I said at the beginning about how this paper you've offered is a great fit for what we're trying to do to start off our 50th anniversary and getting people thinking about not only where we stand, but where we're moving. So thank you again for drawing our attention to things that are all too easily overlooked. Physical space is one of those things that I imagine people don't think about often just because it's set and there's little that prompts them to. And some of the best research, as you know, I think is the stuff that makes us look again at things that, you know, seem readily apparent. So for the details, I will remind our listeners that I've been speaking with Jonas Nordqvist from the Karolinska Institutet and the Karolinska Hospital. And the paper we've been discussing is in the January 2016 issue of Medical Education entitled Alignment Achieved, The Learning Landscape and Curricula in Health Professionals Education. Thanks again, Jonas, for making the time to talk to me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.